And then the shootings from the Israelis didn't stop. It was much less, of course, but it didn't stop. And the fact that the territory, Gaza, still has no normal connection to the outside world, even during the ceasefire, no normal connection to the outside world. I think you mentioned the Israelis never allowed the tents in that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the mobile homes that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the proper number of aid trucks in. They prioritized the wrong type of aid, the wrong types of food, things like snacks instead of things like meat for a population that's been malnourished for a year, and especially milk for children, things like this. And then they didn't allow for the evacuation of medical of wounded people like they said they would, and they tried to restrict, and in fact did restrict, the entrance of foreign medical personnel like myself, coming from the United States, from Europe, from Australia, Jordan, wherever. So overall, the situation actually just continued to get worse. It's true that from, you know, January 19th to March 18th, when there was a bit of a ceasefire, some more food got in, and there was some more water availability, some fuel came in. But on, March 2nd, I think, the Israelis closed the border again. And since then, there has been no way for people to afford protein to eat. They can only afford the bread and rice that they get from the World Central Kitchen, the World Food Program. There has been no resupply of hospitals. The Nasser still has what we need to do life-saving operations to stop people from bleeding to death. But they don't. We don't have the equipment needed to do reconstructive work. So, for example, a lot of people, including children, have had blast injuries to their arms, and they didn't die. So, alhamdulillah, thankfully, great. That's great. But they have nerve injuries. So their hands are clawing. They're not able to use their hand properly. This is going to be a disabling injury forever.
The question, the lack of supplies to Gaza, the lack of all humanitarian supplies for the people here. Since the start of that genocide, all the needs of the people have been weaponized against them. After the start of the ceasefire, the flow of aid, the improvement for the life here should have been achieved. Yet somehow it got worse. By March the 2nd, the suspension of all humanitarian supplies to Gaza, food, the cutting of power to one of the last desalination plants here in southern Gaza. And of course, how this affects the medical facilities here with the patients inside them. Now, many of the people here, the injured, the wounded, are fortunate to have such expert medical professionals like yourself. But even with that, the lack of supplies is pretty much challenging. How do you manage these challenges?
Yeah, so it's a few things. Number one, for my own work as a surgeon, we don't have all of the supplies that we would normally have, even in a poor country's hospital. We don't have wound vac supplies anymore. The certain types of sutures are harder to find. Right now, at Nasser, we do have the equipment that we need to do life-saving care, but not reconstructive care, so that people can improve their lives also. At other hospitals in Gaza, and especially in the north, the supplies are gone. There's very little that's available. They're making do with the wrong things, but they have no choice. Anesthetics are gone. Antibiotics are not available. Thankfully, here the situation is better, but it will not last forever. Because, like you said, the border is closed. So the hospital cannot purchase new material. It can't receive new material. And it's not just humanitarian aid that's not being allowed in. Nothing is being allowed into Gaza. Not normal commerce. You can't purchase something and have it shipped here because the Israelis simply won't allow it. It doesn't matter if you paid for it. It doesn't matter if it's donated. It's nothing. But beyond just the surgical supplies in the hospital, the fact that people don't have clean water means they're coming in sick even before they get injured. The fact that they don't have protein to eat means that their body will not heal properly and they will not fight infections properly, no matter what we do. So, and the fact that they have no homes. I mean, in the background here, you can see every building is seriously damaged. They have no homes, no way of protecting themselves from the weather. So all of this takes a toll on the human body, slowly, slowly, slowly. And all of it is resulting in the health of people being much, much lower than it should be.
And when it comes to this resumption of the large-scale attacks across the Gaza Strip since about March 10, March 18th, How do you describe the situation in the hospital, the number of the patients, the wounded received here? How do you keep up with treating such large numbers?
Yeah, so actually the Palestinians have learned to do what we call mass casualty very well, just from a lot of experience, unfortunately. Not just in this war, but in the previous ones as well, during the Great March of Return, all these things. So they have an efficient system in place, but again, without supplies, without the needed number of surgeons, without the needed number of operating rooms, without beds. I mean, this whole ward has been destroyed, and the 26 beds that were here, we can't use anymore, because how can you house someone in this place? So it's making it very challenging to keep up with the injured. Most of them, even though we can fix their surgical problem, they're still very sick and they need an intensive care unit, the ICU. But we don't have the supplies that are needed, or the personnel, or the infection control measures. All of this is not available. And so many patients that we save in the operating room die in the ICU later, mostly of infections. Simply because we just don't have the supplies, the resources to care for them. We can't test them properly to see what infection they actually have. Here at Nasser Hospital, we don't have a neurosurgeon. The only neurosurgeons are at European hospitals. So if somebody has bleeding in their abdomen, but they also have a bad brain injury in the biggest, this is the biggest hospital in Gaza right now because Shifa is mostly non-functioning. So in the biggest hospital in any place, you would have a general trauma surgeon and a neurosurgeon. They could work on the patient at the same time. But right now, we have to stop the bleeding in the abdomen, hope that the brain injury doesn't kill them for 2 days, and then we can send them to European Hospital for brain surgery. But at that point, they don't even need it anymore. They lived, you know. So these are very, very challenging things. And again, with a population that is so sick to start with, you know, the children have not had clean water for almost 2 years. They've not gone to school for almost 2 years. They haven't eaten normally for almost 2 years. They've been displaced over and over and over again. Their levels of stress are through the roof. They're, you know, so it's a very, very challenging thing to take care of.
So speaking of this ward we are sitting right now, the male surgical department inside the Nasser Medical Complex, a ward filled with wounded people who survived the attacks of the Israelis and finally grateful to receive some sort of treatment that hopefully would help them survive. The Israeli missiles followed them where they are seeking treatment. A man and a boy, how do you respond to this?
Well, they're criminal. And in the case of the attack on this ward, actually, I was almost killed here. The emergency medical teams live on the fourth floor of the hospital, and this is the second floor. And I was coming down to change a patient of mine, his dressings. It was a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim Barhum. I was on my way to change his dressings, and just 10 minutes before the bombing. And I have to walk past the intensive care unit to come down here. And one of the doctors there said, "Oh, Feroz, can you help us with this other patient because they're bleeding and we don't know what to do?" So I said, "Oh, yeah, sure." So I went in there, assessed that patient. That took about 10 or 15 minutes. And then I said, "Look, we need to take this guy to the operating room." So I told the ICU, "You tell the operating room so that they can do that. And then I'm going to come change Ibrahim's dressing, and then I'll come back and we'll do the operation." But when I walked out of the ICU, that's when the bomb went off. And I would have, I assume Ibrahim was right here. I would have been standing right here working, just changing his abdomen, talking to his family, because he was going to go home the next day. He was well. So that hit me very personally, obviously. Number one, because my patient was killed. I've never had a patient killed in their hospital bed before. But number two, I've also never been that close to being killed by a military strike. It's criminal. It's criminal in two different ways. Number one, hospitals are civilian objects in international law. And medical personnel, meaning me as a doctor or somebody as a nurse, whatever, are also protected people. And it's not just the doctors and nurses, it's actually also the administrators that work in a hospital. Basically, everyone who provides care to the wounded is protected. And that's not just part of the Fourth Geneva Convention from the 1940s, I suppose. It's actually part of the very first Geneva Convention of 1864. So we're talking about, you know, during the time of the American Civil War, things that people said should be illegal in warfare, that's what the U.S. and Israel are doing now. It's really crazy. But But number two, so that's one thing. Patients medical personnel in hospitals are protected. But like you you mentioned, hospitals are not to be militarized. And the Israelis have been claiming that Ismail Barhum, simply because he is in Hamas, his presence here is militarization of the hospital. They also said he's planning terrorist attacks here, but that's ridiculous. The hospital is a free area. Everybody could walk around and do whatever they wanted. Nobody saw any such thing. I looked at his picture, actually, because I'd never met him. So I looked at his picture online today. I never saw that man doing anything, walking over. They said he had been here for weeks. It's, you know, it's ridiculous. But so the actual facts of the matter are that he was wounded in a bombing on the, either the 18th or the 19th, and then he came here to seek treatment because he was probably trying to recover without being in public, but then he couldn't, so he came here to seek treatment. And not only are hospitals and medical professionals protected, but wounded combatants, leaving aside that he's not a combatant, he's just a civilian, but wounded combatants are also protected under international law. When a person is wounded in battle, and then they are being cared for by a medical professional, the doctor, but also the patient are protected. So it's a double crime. It's a crime to attack the hospital at all, but it's also even a crime to kill Ismail Barhum. Because, yes, I understand he's in Hamas, he does the finances or something, but that doesn't mean you can just kill him. And we can see it very easily if we take, if we just look at Israel instead. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu had his prostate removed, so it's a surgery, in late December, I think maybe December 27th or something like that. And the next day, I'm sure from his hospital, because he was in the hospital for 4 days, I'm sure from his hospital room, he was running the Israeli war effort. So he militarized a hospital, for sure. Does anyone think that Hamas can go into that hospital and shoot him in the head? No one thinks this. It's crazy. So why is the opposite allowed? Or why is it allowed if the shoe is on the other foot?
Speaking of Benjamin Netanyahu and the militarization of hospitals, I was actually speaking to the director of field hospitals here in Gaza about the targeting of this department. And he said that nothing justifies the targeting of medical facilities. Even if Benjamin Netanyahu himself was being treated inside this hospital, nothing justifies it. Nothing allows anyone to target hospitals.
And just think about it this way. Suppose an Israeli soldier was wounded and a Palestinian brought him here to the hospital and I did surgery on him. Can Hamas bomb this hospital to kill the Israeli soldier in his bed? It's insane. Nobody would accept this.
And the Israelis just keep using this pretext of that hospitals are being used for military purposes by military groups, terrorist groups, and the Gaza Strip. But what is happening is that the Israelis themselves are coming in and turning these hospitals into military barracks. So yeah. What kind of paradoxical concept is that?
Well, it's a good question. And this is where you see that some people are considered human beings in the Western media and some people are not. Not just the Western media, the Western culture in general. The Israelis occupied Turkish Friendship Hospital, which is north of here, just outside of the Netzarim corridor. They occupied it, I think, in July and destroyed almost the entire hospital, just bit by bit, not blowing it up, just smashing this, smashing that, breaking this, breaking that. And a lot of them, the soldiers were putting videos online of them doing this. Oh, look, I'm going to smash this ultrasound machine. I'm going to smash this monitor, just for fun, because they were bored inside the hospital. So they turned it into a military barracks, right? Well, okay, that's militarization of the hospital. They kicked all the patients out, of course, and there was, you know. So that's militarization of the hospital. So if Hamas were to attack Israeli soldiers in that hospital at that time, especially when there's no patients and the hospital isn't functioning, nobody would claim that this is a crime. But now, just a few days ago, maybe on the 17th, I think, maybe on the 22nd, I can't remember exactly, the Israelis went back to Turkish Friendship Hospital, laid out charges, put up a video camera outside the hospital and just blew it up on camera. How could it possibly be justified? But this is the thing, it just doesn't matter in the Western discourse, in the United States, in Europe. It doesn't really matter. Nothing, you're not allowed to just say the simple and obvious truth. The Israelis are deliberately destroying a healthcare system with the backing of the United States and Europe. You're not allowed to just say simple things that are obvious to anybody with half a brain can figure it out. You ask a 10-year-old kid to look at the evidence, they'll tell you exactly what's going on. But you're not allowed to say it. And this is what perpetuates the idea. The only way that this can come about is because Palestinians, Arabs in general, but especially Palestinians, are just not seen as human beings.
So coming to my final question, and forgive me for taking it to a personal level. On October the 2nd, 2024, you, among 99 other medical professionals who served here in Gaza during this genocide, wrote a letter to the Biden administration at the time, urging them to stop arming Israel. In it, you stated your testimonies, what you've witnessed as medical professionals, your expertise poured in that letter, and the atrocities you've witnessed. You said in it, and I quote, "I have never seen such injuries on such massive scale, with so few sources. Our bombs are cutting down women and children by thousands. Their mutilated bodies are a monument of cruelty." The Biden administration is gone. Trump's administration now is in charge. Trump presented himself as the peacemaker, the anti-war president, and all of a sudden, this changed, and is now basically telling Israel to finish the job. How do you, not only as a medical professional, but as an American citizen, what do you think would convince this administration to stop arm Israel?
I don't know what would convince them, but I am a doctor, so I come to places like Gaza. I've also worked in Ukraine. I've worked in plenty of other places, too. And one of the advantages of coming to a place like this is you see that people are just human beings everywhere. Everyone wants to take care of their family. Everyone wants to have enough food to eat. Everyone wants to enjoy their culture. Nothing unusual. And the same is true here. When I go back to the United States, I can tell people about the professional work I did, which I do, but I also want people to understand that we are committing crimes in Gaza. People use the word complicit. They say America is complicit in Israel's crimes, but this isn't correct. That implies that Israel is committing the crimes and we're just in the background or something. The U.S. and Israel are committing crimes in Gaza together. It's American airplanes, it's American helicopters, it's American bombs, even the tanks, these vaunted Merkava tanks, they're basically made in the United States. So I don't accept that my government has to be involved in committing crimes against people who have done us no wrong. So what would convince the Trump administration? I don't know, but I hope something will, and I'll keep trying to find it until I can.
Dr. Farouz Sidwa, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us and for your efforts and everything you've done here in Gaza. Thank you so much for joining us in this special program. Hope you stay safe and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. ربنا
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very important question, and that question is related to one of the prime virtues within Islam. As you know, Islam has given great importance to knowledge and the acquisition of knowledge. And at the peak of this, knowledge that Islam invites us to, there is the knowledge of God. According to some traditions and hadith, it's been narrated that the knowledge of God and His recognition is, in fact, the main purpose of creation. So in this connection, we want to ask today, what is the virtue of gaining knowledge of God? Or what is the result of the acquisition of such knowledge? In order to answer this question, we can take recourse to the hadiths which have been narrated from the infallible imams, alayhim assalam. By way of example, in one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam said the following: "He who attains inner knowledge of Allah has achieved perfection in his knowledge indeed." So knowledge of God is the perfection of knowledge. And if we attain knowledge of Allah, we have actually perfected what we know and perfected our knowledge. In another beautiful tradition, it's been narrated that, again, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The inner knowledge of Allah, glory be to Him, is the highest of knowable truths," meaning out of the things that can be known. And coincidentally, this implies that knowledge of God is attainable. Out of those things that can be known, the highest is the knowledge of God. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that one who attains knowledge of God finds peace. And it also mentions the reason for this. Let's look at this beautiful hadith now. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "He whose heart finds peace in knowing Allah finds peace in being needless of Allah's creatures." What this means is that when we recognize Allah, understand who He is, and realize that He is our Creator and He has all of these great attributes, then we will feel needless of God's creatures, and this will lead to peace of mind and tranquility within our hearts. So tranquility and peace of mind has been mentioned as one of the fruits of, and one of the results of attaining the knowledge of God. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, "He who attains inner knowledge of God and aggrandizes Him forbids his mouth from speaking in vain and his stomach from eating and debilitates himself through fasting and praying." So one of the virtues of, or one of the results of the knowledge of, the acquisition of the knowledge of God, is that it leads to austerity from the world. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtues and results of the knowledge of God in light of the hadith of the infallibles. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Ted Cruz, the Republican senator from Texas, has warned that his fellow Republicans risk a bloodbath in the 2026 midterm elections if Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs cause a recession. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. The first signs of an internal U.S. political backlash against Donald Trump's declaration of a global trade war are starting to emerge amid tanking stock markets worldwide, including on Wall Street, and widespread international criticism of the move. Just hours after Donald Trump unveiled a sweeping panoply of tariffs in an event he dubbed Liberation Day, four Republican senators openly defied him by voting for a Senate resolution from Democrats demanding that the 25% tariffs on Canadian products be reversed. The resolution lacks the force of law, but its support from Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, both of Kentucky, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, immediately signaled the deep misgivings among some Republicans over Donald Trump's tariff gambit, which has triggered a global sell-off of stocks. Mitch McConnell, the former Senate Majority Leader, issued a scathing denunciation after Wednesday evening's vote, calling tariffs bad policy that would trigger economic hardship. Mitch McConnell said in a statement, "Trade wars with our partners hurt working people most. Tariffs drive up the cost of goods and services. They are a tax on everyday working Americans." Further criticism came from Donald Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence, who called the tariffs the biggest peacetime tax hike in U.S. history. Mike Pence posted, "These tariffs are nearly 10 times the size of those imposed during the Trump-Pence administration and will cost American families over $3,500 per year." The four Republicans who voted with Democrats did so despite a public appeal from Donald Trump not to support the resolution, tabled by Tim Kaine, a Democratic senator from Virginia who was Hillary Clinton's running mate in the 2016 presidential election, which Donald Trump won. The resolution was aimed at curtailing the powers that Trump claimed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which he has invoked to tackle the United States' $1.2 trillion trade deficit, and in the case of Canada, cited the influx of fentanyl through its border. We continue with The Guardian's coverage of this story. Mitch McConnell pulled no punches in his attack on Donald Trump's policy. He said, "Preserving the long-term prosperity of American industry and workers requires working with our allies, not against them. With so much at stake globally, the last thing we need is to pick fights with the very friends with whom we should be working to protect against China's trade policies and practices." Mitch McConnell added, at a time when Americans are tightening their belts, we would do well to avoid policies that heap on the pain. We ought to strengthen our friendships abroad and reinforce our allies as pillars of American prosperity and security. Rand Paul, his fellow Kentuckian, said the tariffs were unconstitutional. Rand Paul told reporters, our Constitution was very specific that taxes, tariffs are a form of tax. Taxes originate in the House, come to the Senate, and then go to the President. Rand Paul added, they don't just go to the President and no one else. What kind of system would it be if all of our taxes and laws were passed by one person? He later told Fox News Channel, trade is proportional to wealth. The last 70 years of international trade has been an exponential curve upwards, and the last 70 years of prosperity has been upwards also. We are richer because of trade with Canada, and so is Canada. Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, said tariffs would damage lobstering, agriculture, and the pulp and paper industries in her state, which borders Canada. She also lambasted imposing tariffs on U.S. allies. She said on the Senate floor, the fact is the vast majority of fentanyl in America comes from the southern border with Mexico, rather than the northern border with Canada. She added, one of my biggest concerns is we should be distinguishing between allies and our adversaries and not treating them the same way. Lisa Murkowski, a senator from Alaska, said tariffs would also hurt her state and urged Donald Trump to find a better way to mutually secure our borders and address fentanyl trafficking than by starting a trade war. She posted on X, while not all Canadian trade practices are fair, I'm keenly aware of the negative impacts in store for Alaskan families and businesses should tariffs drive up costs of essential goods. She added, in Alaska, we share more than 1,538 miles of border with Canada. We are friends, we are neighbors, we are partners and allies when it comes to our economies, our mutual defense, our cultures, and yes, our trade. The outspoken Republican criticism hinted at a wider unease in the Republican Party that is mostly being kept muted for fear of repercussions from Donald Trump. Tom Tillis, a Republican senator from North Carolina, warned about potential irreparable damage to his farming constituents before Wednesday's announcement. Tom Tillis told CNN, anyone who says there may be a little bit of pain before we get things right needs to talk to my farmers who are one crop away from bankruptcy. The Economic Times has also covered this same story and tells us more. Ted Cruz, the Republican senator from Texas, has warned that his fellow Republicans risk a bloodbath in the 2026 midterm elections if Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs cause a recession in the United States. Ted Cruz also warned that the president's tariffs, if they stay in place for long, and are met by global retaliation on American goods could trigger a full-blown trade war that would destroy jobs here at home and do real damage to the U.S. economy. He added, 100 years ago, the U.S. economy didn't have the leverage to have the kind of impact we do now. But I worry there are voices within the administration that want to see these tariffs continue forever and ever. The Texan's comments made on his Verdict podcast on Friday, 4th of April, were a further sign that the imposition of global reciprocal duties on imported goods is causing unease among Republicans. The Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa introduced bipartisan legislation on Thursday, 3rd of April, to grant Congress more power over placing tariffs on U.S. trading nations. The bill, co-sponsored by the Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell, would reaffirm the role of Congress in setting and approving trade policy. On his podcast, Ted Cruz warned that tariffs and trade retaliation over the long term could push the United States into a recession. Ted Cruz said, "You would face a Democratic House, and you might even face a Democratic Senate." Ted Cruz warned, "If we're in the middle of a recession and people are hurting badly, they punish the party in power." He added, he did not share the White House's position that the tariffs would usher in a booming economy. But if every other country on earth hits the United States with retaliatory tariffs and Trump's so-called reciprocal levies remain in place, that is a terrible outcome that would destroy jobs here at home and do real damage to the U.S. economy.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
On today's special edition of The Conversation, I will be speaking to Mark Thompson of Relevance for Justice. Given the reaction to judgment by a High Court judge sitting as a coroner into the unlawful killings of four IRA volunteers in February 1982. Mark will be here to discuss the judgment and, of course, give further context into the killings. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me in, Sean.
So, first of all, Mark, can you give us a bit of context into exactly what happened in February 1982?
Well, four IRA volunteers were shot in a hail of bullets. Almost 600 bullets were fired at them in Clonoe Car Park, Chapel, in the Coal Island area, after an IRA operation where they had attacked an empty RUC station. And what transpired in that gunfire, initially the RUC and the British government had said that there was a firefight between four IRA volunteers and a specialist military unit that had been lying in wait on them arriving at the Chapel Car Park. What has transpired now is that there was never a firefight. The IRA had mounted an attack, a propaganda attack, on an empty RUC station, and they had essentially shot concrete. So when they arrived at the Chapel Car Park to dismantle and leave, the SAS were waiting on them, and they killed them. Yesterday, a judge sitting as a coroner, a High Court judge in Belfast, had declared the killings effectively to be unlawful. All four of the men were shot, two whilst running away, and then shot as they lay incapacitated, executed on the ground, and two others were executed. There was an opportunity to make safe and effective arrest under the rule of law and to bring people before courts to face due process. And instead, the UK government, as they have done in many of these so-called set-piece shoot-to-kill incidents, ambushes, they've determined to kill people rather than to proceed with due process. So all the parameters and all the issues around protection of life and safeguarding and safe and effective arrest were dispensed with, and this was basically a murder operation. One of the senior officers, a colonel known as Colonel A, called it the kill zone. And what has transpired is that these men were under intensive surveillance night and day for weeks and days leading into this attack. They posed no threat when they reached the car park. and then they were ambushed in a hail, as I say, of 600 bullets. Now, there's been huge reaction to this from politicians and former British soldiers saying that the judge doesn't know what he's talking about, that this is 30-odd years later, he hasn't examined the facts. Well, the judge examined in great detail the pathology, the ballistics, the forensics. There were experts that looked at the scenes. The scene was recreated visually in every context. The scene was visited. He relied on a lot of the statements made initially at the time by all of these soldiers. And he has determined that it was never effectively and properly investigated. Indeed, he has said it was covered up. And he has said that the men were unlawfully killed. And the reaction, the broader reaction to that, has been one of violence and vilification of these families. These families and their victims of the conflict. These families have had to endure 33 years to wait on an inquest and a verdict that was delivered yesterday. And throughout that period, they'd been harassed and harangued, been to court scores of times. We attended courts in Cookstown and Dungannon preliminary hearings. We've attended courts in Belfast to support the families. The families have led an admirable battle and done society, I would say, a great service in exposing what has happened. And many victims will see themselves in the context of this judgment yesterday. There aren't many days for victims of state violence to receive such a judgment, and particularly in these circumstances, and it's only but right. The rule of law has been applied, and somebody with a clean eye has now, looking at this issue and examined all of the facts. It's not the RUC cover-up that happened, that's been addressed. Are these effective murders? That's exactly what they are. And so in some senses, when the family's been on that journey for 33-odd years, when they were going to courts, they were stopped and harassed. They were taken out of cars. And I think of one of the deceased, Sean O'Farrell, of his brother Austin, who had severe disabilities, who was in a wheelchair, severely disabled, and would have travelled in a special constructed vehicle to carry him to court. How he was oftentimes stopped by the British Army and the RUC at the side of the road, taken out of his wheelchair on one occasion. And the vile commentary and derogatory comments made about his brother and what happened to them, equally the other family members. So they've had to endure all of this. They've had to battle themselves. And very admirably, they've had this result. And now we see the vitriol again and the bile and the hate in social media and from certain politicians and public figures. People like Johnny Mercer, who's defended what's happened in Iraq, what's happened in Afghanistan, who's defended the British Army when they've killed children, civilians, men, women, priests, and now again trying to defend the indefensible, as they often do, and which he's made a career out of. We hear other politicians criticising this judge. This judge examined the facts in minute detail over a considerable period of time and made a verdict and a finding based on the evidence. And the comments that have been made about him are potentially libelous. But that said, you know, we're as an organisation also cognizant of all victims and survivors, of all the hurts by all of the actors of the conflict, all sides. And when I say all sides, I'm not talking about the kind of term all sides here, which is Republican and Loyalist. I also include the British state and everything that they've been involved in, because they were at the heart of this, and the British government were at the heart of these killings. And other families will take comfort from this judgment. In one sense, it's a bittersweet moment, because they see themselves within this judgment of what happened to their loved ones too. And there needs to be reflection in this society for the people that are involved in the hate and the vitriol and the bile and the derogatory comments made about these four young men and their families and the outcome of this case. Because if we're a society that's going to move beyond conflict, we need to deal with justice, we need to deal with truth, and we need to deal with uncomfortable conversations around those issues. And yesterday a judge declared, based on the evidence, that these men were effectively murdered. Now the families will, with their lawyers, consider all of that. And in any other circumstance, if it was anyone else, there'd be calls for prosecutions. And that's probably where this probably needs to go to, because these soldiers were engaged in murder. And so in the context of all of this as well, we have the Legacy Act. And the purpose of the Legacy Act, when you listen to these veterans that don't want to be investigated and their cheerleaders, the consequence is if we had the Legacy Act in place and these inquests had not concluded, that verdict would have been covered up by a Secretary of State and the Intelligence Services, because under the legislation, They would not publish anything that was damning to themselves, and they would use clauses like national security and not in the public interest to proceed and publish that. That's why open justice is important. That's why the rule of law is important. And that's why proper, effective investigation, not only into this incident that took place, that was completely unnecessary and completely avoidable, also into the failure to properly investigate it by the RUC at the time. And so that's the broader context in which this is framed. And here, this is a story about an argument about what the IRA done, and calls, look at the IRA and look what they've done. Yes, the IRA harmed people, and I acknowledge that. But I want people to reciprocate that the families of IRA people killed in the conflict and killed unlawfully, and as in this incident, and the shoot to kill, summary executions, and the use of lethal force that was casually done throughout the conflict, to reflect on those families and their views and their feelings and their rights to truth, their rights to justice, and that the truth, what happened to their relatives, is laid bare too. Because these four young men, had they been arrested and processed, and if they were sentenced and convicted, they would have been out within a few years because of the peace process. And there'd be men now in their mid-40s with their own families grown around them. And they've been denied that. And these families have fought for truth and justice, supported by ourselves, tooth and nail. And we're glad to stand beside them and do that. But along that journey, they've lost parents and siblings that haven't saw this moment. And that's a tragedy in itself. So before people want to hurl abuse and use social media and attack these families and vilify them at the time which they did when the men were killed, they need to step back and think about that. And they need to think about the hurt and the pain that the families of Republicans endured equally as much as anyone else endured. And if somebody reflects back, we did a report in 15 years ago into these killings based on the evidence that we had access to and the disclosure of documents. And some international students that worked for us, legal students doing their masters, two of them have now moved on. One's a lawyer in Germany and the other was a prosecutor, and she is now a judge dealing with international war crimes. They assisted in that report and that research. And we determined that we would name that report Ambush, Assassination, and Impunity, because that's what the evidence showed us. And the judges saw that evidence, and he said more or less the same thing.
And just on the vitriolic responses we have seen, some coming from leading unionist politicians, given the relationship between democratic unionists, and I say that in inverted commas, with loyalist paramilitaries, with the British state, and all the violence that came with that, do you think there's a sense of some cognitive dissonance with unionist politicians? Why do you think that there's a kind of a different reaction to, you know, how we historically look at the past as Republicans as to unionist view that history?
Well, there is some serious self-reflection, I think, that needs to take place, because there are double standards and hypocrisy. I'm quite comfortable to sit here and say that Republicans harmed people during the conflict and visited hurt and death on people who are left behind, families like the families of IRA, dead people as well killed during the conflict. And so we have to humanize this as well. You know, the tears and the hurt and the pain of the parents of an IRA volunteer and their family, it's no different to the pain and the hurt and the tears of a loyalist paramilitary, a British soldier, an RUC person, or the vast majority of civilians who were killed in the conflict. You know, we need to humanize this as well. And so this sense of defending the indefensible and demonizing people and certain individuals, whilst you stand with loyalist paramilitaries on one hand, that you walk in the political talks with them on the other hand, that they assist you in your elections, or you defend them, you know, all of that. You know, we need to get to a place where we can hear each other and we can understand. And the application of human rights and the rule of law and the foundation of justice and democratic principles is how we move away from conflict and build a new society. And if you don't want to listen to those institutions because they tell you through open justice within a British court what you don't want to hear, well then I fear for these people and their contribution that they can make in moving us out into new spheres of transitional justice, transitional society, and going forward. And I reflect back on the report that we did. We put the front picture on the report. And at the time, the family of Barry O'Donnell and Sean O'Farrell and Peter Clancy and Daniel Vincent, you know, they tried to bury their loved ones. And the photograph shows the small church in the graveyard where the mourners attempt to go in with the coffins. And it's lined with several hundred police officers in full riot gear and armed. And that was to stop a flag being put on a coffin. And yet the dignity of those relatives in those moments is inspiring. It's a testament to human resilience, everything that they've endured. And yet again with the verdict, people don't want to listen to that, neither want to vilify the judge. And I really do think in terms of the legacy of the past, between this legacy act, where the state want to hide its sins and use a smothering blanket of national security to prevent any exposure of what they were at, to stop judges in open courts finding the truth and revealing the truth. We've all of that to consider, and people need to reflect. The British Secretary of State needs to reflect. Politicians need to reflect. Society needs to reflect. You know, what messages are we sending to our children and our grandchildren? What hope are we giving for the future? These are important constructs and principles and matters that we need to grapple with. And we did, and we got to a place, and then the British government pulled the rug from under it in terms of the Stormont House Agreement, and they went down this route of amnesty for their own and their agents, and to cover themselves and to prevent the narrative of the truth about what they were involved in. And so we're in this phase where they're trying to shut down the courts because of these types of judgments. And we have this commitment by a Labour administration in opposition to repeal and replace. And now we see they're in the driving seat. And it seems about MI5 is driving this agenda with the security apparatus and the security kind of former security personnel. And the people need to really stand back and have an honest conversation about the hurt that was caused, the damage that's caused, the failure to lance those boys and deal with them in a constructive way in terms of the truths about the past. No more foundations of lies. Let's have the truth. Yesterday was a good day. People will find that difficult and challenging, but it was. And it goes to the heart of the nature, causes, and extent of the conflict that four young men in 1992 joined the IRA. They, for them, thought that was the only option. Now we've transformed society. Now we need to deal with the legacy of the past. And now we need to grapple with all of those issues in a real and meaningful way. Not through the burr pit or the pigsty of some of the debate shows and radios and TVs or the megaphone stuff that's full of vilification on social media. Deal with it constructively, positively as we can. Face into the hurt, face into the pain, and address it and recover and heal. And truth and justice and accountability are fundamental to those matters in terms of obtaining them.
I fully agree, Mark. I want to thank you for coming in today, because it's important that we have these conversations, and it's something that we will be focusing on a lot more on the conversation. So thanks again for coming in.
In the limelight.
While the Western media uncritically accepts Israeli regime claims, a UN report found no evidence of Hamas mass rape, but confirmed Israel's systematic sexual violence, a practice dating back to 1948. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported last week that Israeli soldiers sexually abused two Palestinian brothers they had captured and tortured on the streets of the West Bank last January. This is hardly an exceptional occurrence. The UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Al-Quds and in Israel, has just released a report on systematic Israeli sexual violence against Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank since October 7, 2023. The chair of the commission asserted that the report entitled More Than a Human Can Bear provides such incontrovertible evidence of Israeli regime crimes that there is no escape from the conclusion that Israel has employed sexual and gender-based violence against Palestinians to terrorize them and perpetuate a system of oppression that undermines their right to self-determination. Yet despite the extensive accounts of Israeli regime rapes and sexual abuse of Palestinians since 1948, the Western media remains filled with the stories of Israeli allegations of Palestinian rapes of Israelis. The Zionist regime army has, in fact, systematically used physical and sexual torture against Palestinians since at least 1967, as human rights groups revealed years ago. How, then, does this reality square with Israeli and Western propaganda? The answer often lies in the foundational anti-Palestinian racism that informs these accounts, which are premised on the understanding that Palestinians, unlike white Europeans, including Israeli Jews, are barbarians. Following October 7, the Israelis swiftly alleged mass Palestinian rape of Israeli Jewish women alongside outright fabrications about the decapitation of babies and their bodies being baked in ovens, pictures of which former President Joe Biden claimed to have seen, an assertion the White House later denied. To date, not one Israeli woman has come forward to allege she was raped on October 7, and despite the existence of hundreds of hours of video footage of the operation, not one video has surfaced. Nevertheless, the United Nations issued a report last year claiming that sexual crimes were committed on that day, despite acknowledging the lack of video evidence and the absence of claimants who came forward to make allegations to the UN mission. While resistance movement Hamas denied that any such rapes had occurred by its fighters, the Zionist regime government's claims remain unverified to this day. The Western media's readiness to adopt unverified Zionist regime claims as factual should be contrasted with its neglect of verified Israeli and UN reports on Israeli sexual assaults and rapes of Palestinians, which are often unreported or underreported in Western press. The anti-Palestinian Israeli historian Benny Morris details many instances of Israeli rapes of Palestinians from 1948 and beyond. Despite this horrific record, which only increased exponentially in the following decades, Israeli perceptions of the war were shaped by widespread racism and a sense of Western superiority over Palestinians. Morris's accounts of rape during the 1948 war are hardly exceptional, as rape remained standard practice for Israeli regime troops against Palestinian refugees expelled by the fabricated regime of Israel during the 1948 war, attempting to return to their homes inside Israel between 1948 and 1955. For example, in August 1949, the Zionist regime troops captured two Palestinian refugees. They killed the man, and 22 troops took turns raping the woman before killing her. In March 1950, the Zionist regime troops abducted two Palestinian girls and one boy from Gaza across the new border. They killed the boy and then raped the two girls before killing